violin instruments. Master Luthier, always on premises. Free estimates. ClassicViolins.com. 262-577-5488.
Support comes from the App Factory at UW Parkside. Is your business or nonprofit in need of a mobile app? Student interns at the App Factory make state-of-the-art and user-friendly apps for phones and other mobile devices. Web applications, too. For more information, visit appfactory.uwp.edu.
This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. You're listening to Community Matters, a program that highlights various local issues and organizations. It's co-hosted by Len Iaquinta, a nonprofit manager, fundraiser, and consultant, WGTD Walworth County correspondent Jim McClure, and by Linda Fleshinsky, a mother, grandmother, freelance writer, and former Racine School Board president. And now, here's today's host.
And good morning. I'm Jim McClure, your host this week for Community Matters. Our guest is Chuck Ebling, who is the chief spokesperson for the Yerkes First Foundation, also a former corporate executive for McDonald's Corporation. So we're going to cover everything from Albert Einstein to Ronald McDonald in the course of our 45 minutes together. And Chuck, welcome back to the microphone, and welcome to Community Matters.
Jim, great to see you again after 30 years or so, and great to be together up at beautiful Lake Geneva. It's the Yerkes Future Foundation is actually the name of the organization that a group of community people that I'm part of have created to try to save Yerkes Observatory. So that's the group that's you'll be hearing more about, I hope.
Well, you're putting Yerkes first, but the Yerkes future is what we want to make sure happens, and thanks for setting me straight on that. How did you get involved, or better yet, before we get to that, let's set the stage, first of all, with a little Yerkes history, and then the recent history of how you got involved. So try and explain to people who aren't familiar with Yerkes how important it is historically and in other ways to the community.
Sure. Jim, 125 years ago this year was the 1893 Columbian Exposition, the Great World's Fair in Chicago. And one of the most exciting exhibits at that fair was this incredible monster 20-ton telescope that was the absolute brand-new, state-of-the-art, world's largest lens-type telescope, meaning the kind you look through like a binocular. And that became the telescope that was installed at Yerkes Observatory when it was built a few years later and opened in 1897. It was the world's largest lens telescope then, and incredibly enough, 120-some years later, it still is the largest lens telescope in operation. They subsequently developed reflector-type telescopes and so forth, which are the things you see on the mountains in Chile and places like that today. So not only is the world's biggest telescope, but Yerkes was the world's first astrophysical observatory, meaning it was not just a viewing place, but it had laboratories and rooms where the information could be processed and analyzed in a scientific way. And so it's really a historical site, not just in America, but in the world, as the fountain of modern astrophysics. And you could say the space program was launched at Yerkes Observatory back in 1897.
The aspect of the, I guess they call it the refractor or the great refractor, as I understand it, at 40 inches, there's just something about the physical properties that you can try real hard, at least you could try hard back then. You could not for the life of you make a 41-inch width without the lens breaking or whatever. So that was, I know, part of the limits. And then astrophysics, as it was explained to me, was astronomy is what you can look at, and astrophysics is what you can look at, what it's made of. How the distances, the spectrum, and things like that. And you mentioned the space program. Even things as basic as finding out where the Milky Way was and that we were a part of it, I think, was developed there as well.
Oh, sure. Yerkes Observatory is where black holes were first discovered in the universe. It's where many of the aspects, as you said, the Milky Way, were analyzed. And the photographic plates that were used to take these astronomical pictures through the giant 20-ton telescope have been accumulated for 120 years at Yerkes. And even today, they're able to compare these plates taken 100 years ago with photographs now and determine star shifts that are very helpful in interstellar navigation for the satellites and rockets that we launch today. So there's a relevance to the information that Yerkes has produced over the years. And while it may not be at the cutting edge of experimental astrophysics today, it is an incredibly inspirational place for young people who are interested in all of the sciences. And so it's a wonderful educational laboratory as well, with these wonderful whole series of working telescopes, of which the 40-incher is just the giant largest.
You mentioned that it was in some ways catalyst for the space program. How so? And I know it played a role when the moon landings came about, too.
Well, you know, people like Carl Sagan earned his PhD at Yerkes. The space program was built on the kind of interstellar information that Yerkes and other observatories were helping to accumulate. They never could have figured out how to plan the trajectory for these rockets and satellites without these kinds of observational data being available. So it was a stepping stone to space, both figuratively and quite literally.
Having grown up as a kid that loved, probably both of us, loved watching the space program develop, Mercury, Gemini, Apollo, to think that the landings in the late 60s and early 70s, by which point Yerkes is reaching its 75th year and beyond, still very relevant in that they used its measurements, its pictures of the moon to figure out landing sites, as I understand, as well.
Yeah, I think so. I'm not a scientist here, Jim, but Yerkes has been doing contracts for NASA, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, through the last couple of decades. They've built sensing devices that have gone up into satellites, have been built in the engineering laboratories at Yerkes. When Ronald Reagan created his Star Wars program, the ill-fated Star Wars that was supposed to defend the United States from space, all of the optical technology for that is sitting there in the basement of Yerkes Observatory today, billions of dollars of taxpayers' money in these incredible optics that were created for Star Wars but never used for military purposes.
Right over the entrance, both entrances, it says University of Chicago, Yerkes Observatory. I think, first became operational 5 years after the university was founded in 92, so in 97. Bring people up to speed, if they're not entirely up to it, on what has happened that all of a sudden you and other people are working to save it.
Well, Yerkes Observatory is named that because somebody had to come along back in the 1890s to fund this incredible scientific structure on the shores of Lake Geneva. And the head of astronomy for the University of Chicago and the university's young president, William Rainey Harper, reached out to Charles Yerkes, who was the most hated man in Chicago. because he had built the what's known today as the loop, the elevated rail system around the city, which is a wonderful thing to have even today, more than 100 years later. But he was he was the original slippery developer in Chicago, and did all sorts of underhanded deals to get it done. And he wanted to redeem his reputation, and so by funding this incredible astrophysical observatory, to some extent he succeeded, because today he's really remembered probably more for that observatory than he is for all his shenanigans in Chicago. So after all these years, and the fact that Yerkes Observatory is no longer at the cutting edge of experimental astronomy, the University of Chicago has decided that they really can no longer afford to carry the operating ongoing costs of the facility. And so they made an executive decision announced in March this year, 2018, to close down the observatory October 1st and be open to proposals for those that might want to, as they put it, become new shepherds of the observatory going into the future. And that brings us up to today.
You were, I think you've been a weekend resident for a number of years up here, and then moved up full-time to the Geneva Lakes area. Do you recall the hubbub back in, I think it was 2006, when the university first floated the idea of condos and things? How was that received at the time?
Yeah, back in 2005, the university had developed a plan with an East Coast developer to build a lakeside resort and then residential homes surrounding the observatory itself on the 77-acre campus. And the fate of the observatory building and its telescopes was really left a bit up in the air in that proposal. Based on a lot of what-ifs, the developer might participate in helping to try to somehow save the observatory. The community balked at that proposal for a lot of reasons, one of which the future of the observatory was not secure. Secondly, the lakeside property, the last 550 feet of undeveloped land on the 22-mile shoreline of Lake Geneva, backed by 9 acres of deep, beautiful woods that have been primordial since the days of the Native Americans, thanks to the accidental conservation by the university and the observatory, was going to become a site of chocolate martinis and swim parties. And the beautiful land around the observatory, developed by Charles Olmsted's company, the greatest landscape architect of the 20th century, the guy that developed Central Park in New York, for example, would become a bunch of home sites. So the community spoke out very strongly, very effectively, and said, we just say no. And the observatory ultimately canceled that deal and continued operations at the observatory until now, 12 years later.
And that proposal was a little behind the times in that the architect of the observatory, and indeed much of the University of Chicago, Henry Ives Cobb, did all kinds of houses around it, both for the director and the assistant director, the people who lived there. Those are still here today. And I understand for people who fear that happening, there's two echoes of comfort. One is that the university has said, no, we're not interested in that sort of thing. And we'll talk about that a little more in a moment. But also that you only have so much water to go around. And Williams Bay has tapped out its access to quality water for residential purposes. There's a lot of building there's a large subdivision being finished north of the observatory campus, and then that's going to be it. So we don't have to worry about that, but I believe it was 2 weeks ago, you were in attendance at a fact-finding, fact-hearing session with the university. There was a lot of encouraging news there, I think. Tell me if not, from your perspective, that the university seems to be on board with what a lot of people around the Williams Bay, Lake Geneva area would like to see happen to the observatory.
Well, the university is certainly listening. They're listening to the community. They held that listening session with about 350 people, some said, at the local high school, who spoke out quite openly and directly about their concerns and their aspirations for the observatory campus and the facility itself. There are issues surrounding any potential development of the Yerkes property. Aside from the aesthetic issue of the beautiful natural shoreline and the woods and the Olmsted designed property and the historic building, is the fact that you have many very steep surfaces and so forth, which are difficult to build on, particularly near the lake, and really limit the development potential of the property. Together with the fact that the infrastructure from the village of Williams Bay would be quite expensive to extend to that property because it's been institutional for 120 years. It hasn't had to have the degree of infrastructure, sewage, and things like that support that the residential areas of the city village now have. So clearly the village would be concerned about stepping into deep water financial costs and so forth. So there's a lot of cause for care in this process. And as I said, a group of us community members from around the lake got together a couple of months ago after the university's announcement to discuss Yerkes, and out of that grew this Yerkes Future Foundation, which has put together an expression of interest to the University of Chicago to become the new stewards of the Yerkes campus and buildings, with an intent of continuing their use much along current lines, educational outreach, historical touristic use, and respect for the beauty of the unique beauty of both the facility and the land.
The Dean of Physical Science, Rocky Kolb, was present at that meeting, and when I interviewed him afterwards, he said that they had already had one significant expression of interest, or EOI as they call them. Are you looking over your shoulder or looking in the mirror? Was that you guys, you think, or is there something else out there perhaps?
Well, I think he was referring to, we believe that our expression of interest was the first formal one that the university received. Whether they've received others, we don't yet know. And they had indicated publicly that they thought they would keep that reception process open till the middle of June, which we're a couple of weeks away from now. Our group is already in dialogue with the University of Chicago, and it's been a constructive dialogue up to now, and we trust that will continue to be, and we'll just have to see.
How could you possibly pull this off? We have, I think, in layman's terms in the community, the thought that this is impossible to fund and millions of dollars, or is there a glimmer of factual reality that you couldn't afford it? It's just a matter of getting the right folks together.
Yes and no. Ultimately, there will have to be significant, rather enormous investments to perpetuate the building and the telescopes and an ongoing educational program. However, initially, the costs would essentially be the operating costs of the building, the heat and light and a staff and a program, which is something that we think is doable with the kind of support that we believe that this community and from other areas are possible. Ultimately, millions of dollars would have to be raised for an endowment to fully restore the building to modern standards of handicapped access and modern facilities and so forth within the current structure and possibly addition of future structures for things like a visitor's center or a visitor's residence or something like that. So the answer is if the university is willing and able to turn over your keys on reasonable conditions, we would be prepared to begin the process of raising the funds necessary to keep it open and improve it as needed.
But, Chuck, you feel you've laid enough on the table that if they want to go for your offer, they know enough to say, we'll go with it if it appeals to them. There's nothing else to add in at this point.
Well, we've done a formal expression of interest, but we haven't created a final proposal yet, and that's really dependent on the university deciding that we're the group they want to work with, and that we would be able to take over the property, under the kind of terms that we could deal with. So there's a lot of give and take that has to take place in order to proceed. But like a Mars shot, these days we know it's possible, but we know it's difficult, and yet we're forging ahead. So.
We're at the halfway point in Community Matters. This is Jim McClure. We're speaking with Chuck Ebling, the chief spokesperson for the Yerkes Future Foundation, working to create a viable future for the Yerkes Observatory. The University of Chicago announcing that they will shut down operations as of October 1st. And you're listening on WGTD-FM HD out of Kenosha and Racine on 91.1 FM. Lake Geneva, 103.3 FM, and Elkhorn, 101.7, and around the world and all the ships at sea on WGTD.org. And Chuck Ebling, we really thank you for joining us. So much to talk about with all the hats you wear and have worn. You mentioned 30 years it's been since you and I met. It was the summer of 1988, I recall it well, and I was finishing up my stint as a television reporter out in Virginia. I decided I was going to move to Chicago, and that was the heyday of the informational interview, and I just threw it up against the wall, and three or four heroes answered the call, and you really can't hit any higher on the list than the chief spokesperson for McDonald's Corporation when you're looking to transition from journalism into PR. Was this the sort of thing you'd do often? You must have gotten a million requests a year from young up-and-comers in public relations.
Well, when you're such a highly visible and brand as McDonald's is, you get a lot of attention and a lot of aspirational young communications people, of which I was once one myself, look to McDonald's to see what's going on and whether or not they might want to try to be part of it. So we've always spent a lot of time meeting with young people. I still do that today. As a matter of fact, I had dinner with a university president and a dean last night in Chicago. So I guess there's no shaking. It's a lot of fun working with young people and the people around them, and trying to give people some good ideas to help them plan their own lives.
A lot of people were able to plan their own lives with McDonald's. Talk about that nature. And again, you give me your history first with McDonald's, and then we'll get into how one could literally move up from being a grill person to being president of the corporation.
Well, I had an interesting experience related to McDonald's in the fact that back when I was in college, my best friend went to Loyola University in Chicago and joined a fraternity there. And one of his fraternity brothers was a fellow who went on to become chairman and chief executive officer of McDonald's. And I met that fellow back in college, and a matter of fact, was at his wedding reception in the Ray Kroc's suite in Marina Towers, downtown Chicago, back in the 1960s, and didn't have any contact with that fellow who went on to become chairman of McDonald's for a number of years, until I found myself looking for a new job in the city, and I wound up being hired by their national public relations firm, then called Golin Communications, and still Golin. When I was 29, I went to work for Golin as an account executive, full-time on the McDonald's account, which is a little unusual to be a one-account type agency person. And it was a very enveloping experience because they were the kind of client that was perfectly happy to have your attention 24 hours a day. And so I immersed myself in all things McDonald's, and in over 5 promotions in 7.5 years, I became a senior vice president of that company and co-director of the McDonald's account. And I didn't leave until I felt that I couldn't move any further in my career without going to something on the corporate side. And I joined a giant healthcare company, Baxter Laboratories, as head of corporate communications. And it was interesting that a chairman was reaching out for somebody from the consumer public relations area for a high-tech medical company, but they felt they needed to better connect with a broader swath of the public and investors, and that we'd bring something to the table. And after I'd been there a few years, my old client at McDonald's came along and knocked on my door and said, how'd you like to come to work for us and manage all of that stuff that you were you and your team were doing back at the agency in the 70s. So I became head of corporate communications for McDonald's in 1985, and essentially had that job until I retired at the Millennium.
The interesting points of your two aspects of McDonald's, having worked for the public relations communications agency serving it, and then as an executive on the inside. Thinking back, it may have been just before your tenure. McDonald's has certainly enjoyed its combination of praise and criticism. Wasn't one of the first criticisms back in the early 70s, mid-70s, that you were too cookie cutter, too much red and white tile? You had to reflect architecture, at least the communities that McDonald's was in, and that's when we started seeing the original design kind of change a lot.
Well, the restaurant business is a challenging one in a number of respects, and one of which is you have to remain relevant to what your customers are interested in doing and what they're interested in eating, if you're a restaurant in particular, but also the ambiance, the setting in which you do what you do. And anyone who's owned a restaurant knows that if you don't redecorate or refit things every 3 or 4 years, you're starting to become less relevant in relation to what other people are coming along doing. So McDonald's was no exception to that rule, and I think McDonald's has evolved within their core concept of basically being about hamburgers and French fries and fast service, as we said at McDonald's, quality service, cleanliness, and value. That's what the customer wants, and you need to figure out how to keep giving it to them in a way that they think is interesting. You know, after all, when it comes right down to it, the McDonald's menu is basically meat and potatoes and vegetables served in a way that people want. And that's what makes it a success. But when it comes right down to it, it's not that different than the core menu that sit on people's dinner table every night.
The meat, potatoes, and vegetables has evolved as a society. Have to bring up, of course, after your tenure, the whole furor with the fellow that decided he'd start a documentary where he ate nothing but McDonald's. And certainly there was a variety. I mean, you could eat breakfast, lunch, and dinner, literally. Boy, I can remember during your tenure at the agency, I think it was David Letterman was just starting to substitute for Johnny Carson. And he'd say, boy, now you can have breakfast at McDonald's, is one of his lead-ins. That's how fresh an idea it was. But was it Morgan Spurlock, I think, came up with this this concept that he would try and eat for 30 days, and sodium levels being what they were. How would you have liked to still be in the center seat then when all that controversy erupted? And in his documentary, he's busy getting sick and calling some poor spokesperson. I remember her voice was being recorded. As a corporate communications professional, would that have been fun in a challenging way or just a total nightmare to be handling that tough period in McDonald's corporate existence?
Well, you know, people love rumors and suggestions that there's something insidious going on or something sneaky going on in various institutions in our lives. So, yes, it's an enormous pain in the you-know-where when these kinds of rumors and things start to take hold, and when it affects your business and the people who work for you, you get very concerned about it. Unfortunately, Mr. Spurlock has turned out to be a phony. If you followed the news at all recently, he was a long-term alcoholic during this whole period, and not exactly a reputable character. But I think, you know, the customers vote with their choices about what to do, and McDonald's business continued to flourish without a beep during that whole period.
There's so much talk today about fake news. I have my own thoughts on it, but from your experience, from decades of journalism and working with and for journalists, where have we come as a society in terms of getting our news, and how reliable is it?
Well, you know, we have within every opportunity, there's a problem. And we've had this incredible opportunity to have an expanding universe of information available to every single person who's capable of looking at a screen or pushing a button. We have, where there used to be three channels on television, there now are hundreds. Where there used to be letters sent by mail, there's now the internet. So we have all these wonderful choices of places to go for our information and our entertainment. And it becomes more and more challenging for the average person to sort out where they're getting good information and reliable information versus some kind of hyperbole or something with an agenda. And so there are wonderful journalists and there are wonderful sources more than ever of every kind of news that you could want. But it's kind of in some ways left to the individual to sort out what to trust and what to believe. And look at how Facebook is having to try to reinvent itself from being this ultimate party line on the internet to a place where people were being manipulated by advertisers, you know, representing Russian political interests and things like that. So I now see billboards up from Facebook showing how much they care about your privacy and so forth. And so I think we're going through a kind of a revolution in information. Some of what's going on is good, but there are a lot of pitfalls.
We have to talk about my personal favorite item, which is food, and all the innovations as McDonald's has tried. Before we get to becoming a purveyor of coffee, which seems to have done well, and all the different gourmet burgers, let's talk about those wonderful experiments. Now, in the years before I met you, when I was first starting out in television, I worked in Evansville, Indiana. It was my understanding at the time that Evansville was one of those perfect little towns where it was the exact same demographic as America, and so things would be tried out there. So what was the basis for McDonald's introducing something, and then we'll go through McPizza, McLobster, and all those different things?
Well, again, it's relevance. It's being relevant to what people are interested in, and also in the food area, giving people some news, some food news, something new, something hopefully positively unexpected. McLobster up in the Northeast, the land of seafood. It was probably inevitable that McDonald's would try a lobster sandwich. McDonald's gave pizza a shot. I think the pizza was as good as any of the really fast service kind of pizzas you can get, but ultimately not distinguished perhaps enough to maintain a permanent place on the menu. You know, Ray Kroc, who was the founder of the modern company McDonald's, loved to experiment with food. He had a favorite thing. He was trying to come up with something for Catholics to have on Friday when they had to avoid meat. And he came up with a product called the Hula Burger. And it was a toasted bun with a slice of cheddar cheese and a slice of grilled pineapple. And he thought it was fabulous, but he'd serve it to people and they'd say, well, I see the hula, but where's the burger? And ultimately it was up to a McDonald's franchisee, Jim Delegati, who came up with the filet of fish as a Friday offering, and then became part of the regular menu because people liked a fish sandwich so much. Back then it was considered revolutionary that a McDonald's, the hamburger place, would have a fish sandwich. Well, today, one statistic about McDonald's a lot of people are unaware of is McDonald's serve more chicken than they do beef in most of their markets around the world for a number of years now, but we're still known as the hamburger place, and that's fine. You know, the chicken McNuggets, there's chicken sandwiches, there's salads with chicken on them and so forth. And so if it's something that people will eat, McDonald's will probably ultimately try it. Over in Southeast Asia, they have a fruit called the durian, which to most Western tastes is a repugnant fruit. Well, we serve a durian milkshake in Southeast Asia, and they love it. You wouldn't get close to the smell over here. So McDonald's, in some ways, is a Rorschach test for what people are interested in food. And if enough people are interested in having it often enough, McDonald's will probably give it a try at some point. On the other hand, it's not that gourmet place where you're going to go to for that one thing that the chef specializes in, and there are 22 people in town that are interested in it. That's not McDonald's.
A lot is being talked business-wise about Foxconn, located in the Racine, Kenosha area. Is it safe to bet that when this thought of 13,000 jobs coming in and construction starting within the next year or so, is there a consortium or a chain of McDonald's executives or franchise owners that are saying, wow, there's a real opportunity here?
I have no idea. First of all, as you noted at the beginning, I've been retired since the millennium, so I'm not plugged into McDonald's development plans, but I know the company is developing many new restaurants across the U.S. And is always in a process of relocation, too. A site that was a wonderful, convenient location for people in 1972 may not be the best place convenient place to offer service in 2018 or 19 or 20. So McDonald's is always looking at demographics. Back in the old days, the early days of McDonald's, Ray Kroc used to charter a plane and fly around, and he'd look for the church steeples, and he'd say to his construction guy, get us sites as close as you can to those church steeples, because that's the core of those communities, and that's where we want to find the families we're going to do business with.
Quality has to be the key to hanging in there when burger chefs and others have fallen by the wayside. And I read today that many popular dinner destinations are all falling by the wayside because of the changing demographics and things. Was quality the key, and did it come right down to Ray Kroc walking out into the parking lot and picking up burger wrappers himself if the manager wasn't taking care of things?
Sure. I saw Ray Kroc do that myself. And a matter of fact, there's a restaurant in downtown Chicago, a McDonald's, where there's a bronze statue of Ray Kroc bending over to pick up a piece of trash in front. He had a saying which was integral to McDonald's crew training program: if you've got time to lean, you've got time to clean. And when McDonald's developed ultimately its motto for its business, that motto became quality, service, cleanliness, and value. And McDonald's has an entire operations program around each of those qualities, and those are the things that undergird the sort of sexy contemporary setting that McDonald's offers customers.
Chuck Ebling, former corporate spokesperson for McDonald's Corporation and current spokesperson for the Yerkes Future Foundation. I want to thank you for a wonderful interview, and good to see you again on a personal basis.
Great. Thanks, Jim. It's been fun getting together again. We'll have to do this every 30 years like clockwork.
Sounds good to me. This is Community Matters. Your host, Jim McClure. You have a great Saturday and a blessed Saturday afternoon.
You've been listening to Community Matters. All programs are archived at WGTD.org. Click shows. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, that's what keeps you coming back. Visit jackandrea.com for more information.
Support for WGTD comes from Piasecki Althaus. Since 1931, Piasecki Althaus has provided unmatched, compassionate service and are dedicated to your family, guests, and supporting the community. Piasecki Althaus Funeral Home, honoring personal legacies and the circle of life. 262-658-4101. I'm Gregory Berg, and on Monday's morning show, a very timely conversation about the relationship between the United States and Mexico. My guest, Andrew Seeley, is responsible for a fascinating book called Vanishing Frontiers,